You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
In case you don't know, that's you too. I've been talking about this for a while, and looking for somebody who can do for the program what everybody knows what Grant Newsham does relative to the Pacific Rim and China and North Korea. So I actually found somebody, and she joins us now as Mrs. Smith, and that's about all you're going to know about her for a variety of different reasons, but we don't care about that. So first of all, Mrs. Smith, welcome to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
All right. The so your role now is to explain to us that which we don't understand and that which the news doesn't do a very good job of educating people on in terms of dynamic forces in the world that contest the United States, that thwart America's desire for whatever we want. And Iran is always up there at the top. So where do you want to start this discussion?
Well, first I want to say I've been asked to do interviews a number of times, and I always decline them. But since you said I could have sense of humor and profanity, I thought this was a great opportunity.
Well, I always say it's like NPR, but with profanity and a whole lot funnier. So that makes you're obviously rising on the list of stars on my horizon. So
that's great.
That's good. No, but that's a perfect place to start. The
well, I hate to say it, it's like Iran is always a topic that is just so serious.
Oh my God!
And there are a lot of sensitivities with all of this, and unless I could just be super candid about a lot of things, it's very hard to tiptoe around certain subjects. So this is good. It's a perfect venue.
Well, you know what, and honestly, for a lot of I won't say a lot of Americans, but if you live here in Southern California, I mean, you told me what the largest expat, you know, gathering of Iranians is here in Southern California?
Oh, yeah, that's why we call it L.A. Tehrangelis. If you've got all the Persians just rounded up in L.A., it's a great place to be if you want good Persian food and just, you know, feel like you're in Little Persia in certain areas. I think actually Beverly Hills has the highest number of Persians within L.A. And somebody told me that over 50% of Beverly Hills is Persian. I don't know if that's true, but that is a lot of Persians.
I got told that by somebody. They said, oh, my God, they've taken over all of Beverly Hills. I said, what? And they said, yeah, it's like Little Persia now. Yep. Everywhere you go is this. Now you use the term Persian. How about we start with differentiate between Persian and Iranian? Are they synonyms?
That's a good question, because if you ask different Persians this question, they'll probably give you different answers. But I'm just going to give you my take on this, because there are so many different answers. So when you say Iranian, you're referring to a national identity, right? When you say Persian, you're referring to a culture, you're referring to an umbrella, you're referring to an umbrella ethnic group. So here's the thing that I always talk about. So I've trained Marines for a number of years, and this question always comes up. So if you look at the most reliable source in the world on countries, which would be the CIA World Factbook, they will probably tell you that Persians are the largest ethnic group in Iran. And then you've got all these other minority groups like Azeris and Kurds and this and that, that are all completely separate from Persian, which they label as an ethnic identity. Now, here's the problem with that. In Iran, the definitions that we have for Persian and Iranian in the United States don't fully translate over there. Because, of course, Iran, before it was called Iran as a country, it was called Persia. And if you tell, for example, what we label as a minority group, an Azeri, if you say, hey, Azeri, you're not a Persian, you're considered something else, they'll get offended by that. Because they're going to look at you and they're going to say, what, I wasn't a part of this great Persian civilization that has been existing for a number of years? So they kind of see that as somewhat offensive. So it doesn't exactly translate in the Persian language the way that we look at it over here. So for the purpose of our discussion and what we typically look at politically, when we say an Iranian, we're referring to a national identity. So that's their nationalistic group. If you say Persian, you're talking about an ethnic identity and really an umbrella identity that encompasses a lot of groups that have been a part of the Persian Empire for a number of years.
All right. Talk to us now. I'm just going to go down my list of questions, okay?
In
this kind of liberal arts discussion. Talk to me about can we do a little history first? Iran, when I was a kid many, many years ago, was a great friend of the United States. The Shah of Iran was a favorite of the United States. And we had this incredibly close relationship with Iran. Can you talk to us about what happened in the 70s and then how Iran has kind of changed? Can you give us a little history lesson on it?
Sure. So it's interesting because if you ask an American, like, what happened? Where did this all go wrong? Like, why do we hate each other? The answer that an American will give you is going to be very different from the answer that an Iranian will give you. So, for example, where it all went south, or even let's just say when you think about Iran, what are all the bad things that you think about? They're going to say hostage crisis.
Right.
They're going to say these Iranians are always after those damn nukes. And then they're going to talk about Shia militia groups in the region, right?
Right?
So really the start of the relationship that we can remember when it all went south is Iran hostage crisis. Because all we know is that, hell, before that, our buddy was in power over there. The Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, he was our buddy. We labeled that guy as the police of the Middle East. He was our best friend over there. But if you ask an Iranian, hey, when did all this go south? They're not going to point to that. They're not going to say the Iran hostage crisis. They're going to say, whoa, 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 wait a second. Time out. America has been meddling in our biz for a number of years. And they're going to point to 1953, when under the Eisenhower administration, we launched a coup that overthrew, really, if you think about it, the first and only truly democratically elected leader in Iran, which was Mohammad Mossadegh, who was the prime minister of Iran, and we actually supported a coup that got rid of this guy. And the reason for that is because there was a prime minister in the 50s who basically said, you know what, it doesn't make sense that all these good resources in Iran, all this oil, is being shipped off to the Brits, and the Brits are getting the majority of the benefits of Iranian oil. There was an oil company that was joint-owned by the British and the Iranians, and they were actually getting the majority of the profits from this oil industry. And meanwhile, you have Iranians that are suffering. There's poverty issues. There's a number of different things going on. The economy is not really great, especially in the rural parts of the country. And people were really starting to get pissed off at why is all this oil wealth going to the Brits? And so when Mossadegh came in as the prime minister, he kind of really looked a lot more powerful, I would say, than the Shah of Iran at the time. He was more popular because he wanted to nationalize that Iranian oil industry. And that really pissed off the Brits. And when the Brits came to the United States for some help, they were like, hey, what are we going to do here? Because this is not good. We're going to lose a lot of money off of this. We're going to lose our influence in the region. And all they had to do for the Eisenhower administration is to paint Mossadegh as one figure, which was a communist.
Right.
Now, granted, Mossadegh, he had some communist tendencies. I wouldn't say that he was like the leader of the communist party in Iran, because there was actually a separate party in Iran that was communist. But it was a pretty convenient thing to say, look, this dude is a communist and we got to get rid of this guy. And that's pretty much exactly in a nutshell what happened. So under the Eisenhower administration, under a CIA operative named Kermit Roosevelt, basically launched a coup of, look, I'm giving you a very nutshell version of this. This is like the Cliff's Notes version of a lot of drama that happens.
Got it.
And so when we launched this coup, we got rid of Iran's democratically elected leader. You really think about their history. This is the one true democratically elected leader that they've had. Got rid of this guy. And that's what Iranians really pinpoint as the beginning of a poor relationship. We got off on the wrong foot in 1953. And so at that time when Mossadegh was out, we put Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi back into power as the key supreme leader in the country. And we were buddies with that guy because we helped that guy stay in power. And he had some ambitions that were very similar to his father. He wanted to modernize the country. He didn't want to be, you know, labeled as another Middle Eastern country that was just launched in between, you know, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Arab countries. He wanted to be different. And in fact, in a previous dynasty, the reason why the country of Persia was renamed Iran was because Iran actually means Aryan. They wanted to tell the world, hey, look, we're not Semitic peoples. We're not like Arabs. This is a different country here. We're actually Indo-European. And in fact, the Persian language is an Indo-European language. And he wanted to compete with European countries. He wanted to compete with America. He wanted to be in that same category. So modernizing the country really became key. It was all about, you know, bringing in Western influence to say, yeah, we can play with the big boys too. And of course, you do that, you're really going to piss off a whole lot of people. For example, the religious people in Iran, the clergy, the pious poor. You got to think at that time, the rate of urbanization was pretty low in the 70s. So you had a lot of people living in rural areas, and they were a lot more religious. They weren't really reaping the benefits of the country's modernization process. And when the relationship between Iran and the United States grew in the 70s, a lot of these individuals in Iran started seeing some things that they really didn't like. For example, Playboy became big in Iran. They started seeing, you know, magazines and cabarets and liquor stores and all sorts of things that they thought as immoral behavior. And not only that, but Americans, in addition to other Westerners that were operating in the country because of the oil industry and other industries that existed where we had partnerships, they were kind of behaving with impunity. And a lot of Iranians were kicking back and watching, you know, Americans breaking laws, you know, all this cultural influence coming in that they didn't want to see, at least the individuals who were not reaping the benefits of it because, you know, middle class and higher people who were closer to the monarchy, they got tremendous benefits from this.
Right.
But the majority of people in the country were really pissed off. And so that really gave way to a lot of anti-Shah sentiments because so many people in Iran were saying that, you know what, this is not a great Persian leader. This guy is just a freaking American puppet. So we got to get rid of this guy. And it wasn't a matter of, you know, a bunch of religious people that got together and all of a sudden they just wanted to create an Islamic Republic of Iran. You had communists that were involved against the Shah. You had people who wanted democracy involved. You had certainly people who wanted a more religious government. You had a number of different individuals who all wanted something different. But you know what? They were united by one thing. And that's the fact that they saw the Shah as corrupt. They wanted to get rid of this guy. And long story short, 1979, a series of events happened, which in the midst of so many people hating one individual, one person kind of rose to power, very charismatic individual, started giving all these different speeches about how the Shah of Iran is really the biggest problem. He's an American puppet, blah, blah, blah. He was in exile at the time, first in Iraq and then to France. His name is Ayatollah Khomeini. And this guy, look, you Google this guy and you see pictures of him. It is very rare to find a picture of him smiling. He looked angry.
Right.
Like, he means business, you know? He was all about business. He was very angry at the situation in Iran. And people listened to him because he was constantly giving all these speeches left and right about how, you know what, this is the narrative. This is, it's a play on a previous narrative that's like the passion story of Shia Muslims, which Iranians are Shia Muslims. They're very different from other Muslims throughout the Middle East. Actually, the majority of Muslims are Sunni Muslims in the Middle East, but Iranians are Shias. And a part of their Shia history really rests on a passion story where in Islamic history you have an individual who was the grandson of Muhammad, who was known to be the prophet of Islam. And in his passion story, he represents the oppressed, which rises up against the oppressors, which at the time they were considered to be what we know today as Sunni Muslims. And this passion story of the oppressed rising up against the oppressors is constantly told over and over and over again. And when Ayatollah Khomeini came into the mix, he was basically saying, look, Iranians, this is our Shia story all over again. We are oppressed, and the Shah of Iran is the oppressor. So everybody needs to rise up and get rid of this guy, because this is your destiny. This is your duty as a Muslim to defeat those who are oppressing you. And it was effective.
Right.
And it was so effective, in fact, that they were recording this dude's speeches on cassette tapes and copying them and copying them and copying them. And all of a sudden these speeches are found all over the place. They're popping up in Lebanon with Shia communities there. They're popping up in Iraq. This guy's given all sorts of motivation to all these different Shia groups who for so long have felt oppressed in their majority Sunni areas. And it really gave them a lot of motivation regionally. Now, back to Iran, this was not a Sunni-Shia fight. This was purely oppressed versus oppressors. And people started feeling the calling to get rid of this guy. In fact, one of the biggest things that helped with the success was the fact that the military was also on board. So long story short, get rid of the Shah in 1979, and Ayatollah Khomeini basically says that all these problems are inherently tied to the great Satan, which is the United States. The reason why the problems in Iran exist is because the United States meddled in Iranian politics. They tried to influence Iranian culture and behavior. They had immoral behavior throughout the country. And Ayatollah Khomeini was a very charismatic individual who was able to fuse the creation of what became an Islamic Republic with the hatred of America, with the fact that this is all America's fault. So even today, how I relate this to today, sometimes I get people asking me, can America and Iran ever become friends? And my answer to that is, well, if you're talking about the Islamic Republic of Iran, it's kind of hard to see that being the case, because the entire foundation of the Islamic Republic is based on hatred of America. That's why it was created. So it's kind of hard to see the United States and the Islamic Republic ever truly becoming friends, because if they do, the entire reason of why the Islamic Republic of Iran was created, that foundation becomes eroded. So that's how that relates to what's going on today. Now, shortly after that revolution, of course, the neighbor of Iran, Iraq, led by Saddam Hussein, they started hearing Khomeini's, you know, calling on all these different Shia communities. As we know today, and as we've known for some time, the Shias in Iraq are the majority. And Saddam Hussein, being a Sunni leader, even though he was, you know, there was separation of church and state, but when he was a Sunni leader in Iraq, he wasn't exactly very nice to the Shias, wasn't exactly very nice to the Kurds. And Khomeini convinced the Shia communities in Iraq that they were also oppressed, and actually started kind of riling them up to take some action. You got to think, Iran was a great example for a lot of different Muslim communities throughout the region who felt oppressed by their leaders. When that revolution was successful, when the most powerful leader in the entire Middle East, America's buddy, was overthrown by an Islamic Republic, that gave a lot of motivation to a lot of different groups, a lot of different people who felt like they were kind of in the same boat. And, you know, my father used to tell me that in Iran, when Khomeini just came to power in 1979, when he came back to Iran and he started leading this country, one of the first things that he did was, you know how in America we've got, you know, road signs. If you say, you know, Washington, D.C. is 30 miles away, you'll see that on the road. It'll say Washington, 30 miles. Baltimore, 100 miles, however far away it is.
Right.
He said that one of the things they actually started doing in Iran is that they started including the city of Karbala in their signs to say Karbala was X number of miles away. We have to go and liberate Karbala. Of course, Karbala is a city in Iraq, Shia heavy. And Khomeini didn't want to just liberate oppressed people in Iran. He wanted to liberate especially Shias who were oppressed all over the world. And Iraq was just the next step. So there was a lot of saber rattling. Now, that's the Iranian side. On the Iraq side, you have Saddam Hussein, who was hungry for water access, the Shatt al-Arab, very small strategic waterway connected to the Persian Gulf. And a number of different issues contributed to an invasion that Iraq initially led into Iran, a combination of saber-rattling and strategic interests. 8 years of war, and there was one lesson that Iran learned in this 8 years of war. It was terrible. You had pretty much 8 years, and after that 8 years of war, nothing really changed. The borders didn't really change. A lot of people died. Over a million people died on the Iranian side, although the numbers are disputed. But nevertheless, you had one lesson that came out of the 1979 revolution, which was, look, America's bad and monarchies are bad. And then you had a pretty important lesson that came out of the Iran-Iraq war for Iran, which was, we have no friends. Because every country that was involved in the Iran-Iraq war supported Saddam Hussein. So if you're Iran, you're looking at the situation going, shit, I don't have any friends. Nobody likes me in the region. Monarchies are clearly not a good thing. America's the devil. And those are really the key things that has shaped the Islamic Republic's worldview today. If you look at everything that they're doing in the region, it is entirely because they say, the reason why they've got so much regional influence now is because that's a lesson learned from the Iran-Iraq war. They say, look, if we don't find some friends in the region, we're going to be in a lot of trouble if something happens. So this is why they have so much influence in Iraq today. It's part of the reason why they have so much influence in Syria, in Lebanon, growing influence in places like Yemen, of course, which is what we're seeing with the civil war. Trying to grow their influence in other places that have large Shia communities like Bahrain. It's because they know they don't really have a lot of friends in the region. And if people don't understand what came out of that Iran-Iraq war as far as the mentality of where Iranians were at that time, they're really going to have a hard time unpacking why Iran behaves the way that it does in the region.
All right. I want you to explain to us now, can you explain to us a little bit about the geography and the population centers of Iran, and then kind of, as you kind of go through that, and then talk to us about how you alluded to it a little bit ago, saying that this wasn't just a rural fundamentalist support for, I think, the conservative religious figures. I think you kind of paraphrase it like that. So could you explain, you know, the Iran geographically, Iran's population centers, and then how the population kind of divides up politically? Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. So Iran is a pretty big country. We're talking about the size of Alaska. You have over 80 million people who live in Iran. And in fact, that's Iran's biggest advantage. That's their strategic advantage is manpower. They have a ton of people that live in that country. So if you think about it in comparison, the entire population of Iran is about the same as the entire Arabian Peninsula. So that's pretty significant. I always say when people ask me about, you know, Iran and Saudi Arabia in comparison in the region, I always say, you know what, Iran has the advantage of manpower, Saudi Arabia has the advantage of money. And manpower really separates them in the region as far as, you know, the type of people who live in Iran. So at the time in the 70s, as I was referring to before, rate of people living in rural areas was much higher. Today, Iran actually has one of the fastest rates of urbanization in the world. It's a very urban country. There are a lot of people living in large cities. Biggest city, of course, is the capital city, Tehran. You have about 14 million, although this is disputed, but you have about 14 million people living in Tehran. If you're talking about the full metropolitan area of Tehran, about 1 in 4 people live in that area. You also have large centers such as the city of Mashhad, which is the city that is the closest to Afghanistan. You do have a lot of Afghan refugees in that area as well, but it's a very large city. There is a major shrine that is also in the city of Mashhad. It's a Shia shrine, so you'll see a lot of Shias that, you know, go on their pilgrimages. Shias from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from a number of different places that will go on a pilgrimage to see this holy site in the city of Mashhad. You also have the city of Isfahan in Shiraz. And the cool thing about all these different population centers is that they're all kind of known for something. So Mashhad being a little bit more of a religious city, primarily because of the Imam Reza shrine that exists over there. Tehran is kind of like the New York City of Iran. This is where, you know, all the pop culture and everything of Iran really starts. You've got a lot of really hip, interesting fashion trends. People there really like to mimic the trends that are going on in Europe, for example. I can tell you that years ago when I used to go to Iran, and, you know, I was like the American girl that was in Iran when I was there.
Right.
It was like I was the most behind person when it came to the fashion world. Everyone is very in tune with their appearance, with how they look. You know, they, even though there are so many restrictions in Iran, I mean, you got to give it to the youth there. They're very creative. There's so many restrictions on you got to cover your hair. You got to do this. You got to do that. Blah, blah, blah. But people really do get creative on really kind of, you know, showing their personalities, even with all those restrictions. It's amazing. I can tell you one of the funniest things. I remember every year that I would go to Iran, so they have this... For women, you have to, of course, wear a head covering.
Right.
And you have to wear, they call it a manto, which is kind of like a light trench coat, if you will. It
right.
kind of looks like a light trench coat. It's something that, you know, buttons down. And it basically is a cover over your clothing.
Right.
Or the option is you can wear a chador, which almost looks like, you know, a sheet covering. This is something that people probably more often see. If you ever see Iran in the news, more than likely you're going to see the women that are in the black chadors.
Right.
But most young people in Iran, they wear what's called a manto, which is kind of like a light trench coat. And I remember every year that I would go to Iran, the trends would change. And if I wore the same trench coat that I wore last year, I was so out of fashion because they're constantly pushing the red lines. So every year, what was permissible for you to wear as your trench coat would go up a few inches higher. The next year, it'd be a little bit shorter. The next year, it would be a little bit shorter. I remember in the 90s, these things had to be all the way down to your knees. And now when you look at the pictures of, you know, what people are wearing in Iran, they're like, you know, up to their mid-thighs. So people are constantly kind of, you know, pushing things to the limit to see what they can get away with. In the 90s, I remember covering your hair with a headscarf. I mean, your hair had to be covered if you were a woman, completely covered. But today it's like your ponytail sticks out, you know, you've got quite a bit of hair in the front that's showing, your blonde highlights are shining through. So people kind of get away with a lot today compared to what it was before because they're always kind of testing the limits and seeing how far they can push things. So
okay, let me ask, why is Tehran the capital? What is there something significant there? How did it's in the north, the central part of the country. Why is Tehran the capital?
So it's a good question. I'm probably not going to be able to give you the full history of that, but I can tell you Tehran is a city that's surrounded by mountains.
Okay.
It is a very protected city. Previous capitals included, you know, Persepolis, Shiraz area. Over time, the capital's moved to Tehran. It's very strategic. Like I said, it's surrounded by mountains, and this has been the capital for a number of years.
Got it. Okay, and the Mashhad is in the northeastern corner, as you said, in near Afghanistan. And and then the third city, Isfahan?
Esfahan, yep.
Esfahan.
Actually, that was always my favorite city. Always my favorite. There's so much culture and so much history and old palaces and just so many amazing, there's like a hotel there that was an old palace that was converted to a hotel. It is really just a stunning city, but unfortunately today there's a lot of water issues and things like that are going on throughout the country. So the main river that used to flow in the center of the city is pretty much completely dried up. So compared to the time that I used to go there, it's a little bit different now because they do have a lot of resource issues.
All right. And that's like smack dab, it looks like, kind of in the center of the country.
Yep, south of Tehran, yep.
Okay, all right. Keep going. Other major cities and then how the population, you said 25% of the population lives in Tehran. What percentage of the population of Iran is urban based or in a major metropolitan area as opposed to rural?
So I would say higher than 90% urban for the most. So it's a very urbanized country. You definitely have other population centers. You have Tabriz, which is a city in the northwestern side of the country. It is very much Turkic influenced. You'll find a lot of people who speak the Azeri language, which is a hybrid language of both Persian and Turkish. You have some cities further in the south that are also pretty densely populated, I would say. There's different cultural influences there as well. If you look at the southern part of Iran, it's pretty close to, it's in the Persian Gulf, or Arabian Gulf, which, by the way, I know that becomes a big dispute of a topic, just in case if anyone's knowing, if anyone wants to know, and I'm not just saying this because I'm Persian, but it's the Persian Gulf.
Get out. Well, I mean, I want to say that when you saw the Arabian Gulf referred to, it was a very specific part of. No, I take that back.
Let's unpack that.
I was being.
It's very political.
Okay.
It's super, super political. So let's talk about that for a second. So about 98% of the world calls that the Persian Gulf.
Right.
And the reason why we have a little bit of a name dispute, and it totally makes sense. In fact, when I'm training Marines, I always tell them, you know what, call it the Arabian Gulf, because here's why. The official naming authority of the United States for bodies of water, things like that, that comes from the Department of State. The Department of State calls that the Persian Gulf. The Department of the Navy calls that the Arabian Gulf, and you know what, it's for good reason. Because we have a lot of really nice Arab hosts in the region. And we've got a lot of bases and relationships with Arab countries. And the Arab countries are kind enough to give us, you know, some pretty good opportunities to work with them. We have bases, we have strategic interests and partnerships, et cetera, et cetera. And the last thing that we want to do to our really nice Arab hosts in the region is poke them with a short stick and call that damn thing the Persian Gulf. That's not very nice.
Right.
This is a long dispute that has been going on for a number of years. Between Persians and Arabs, that, you know, one wants to call it the Persian Gulf, the other one wants to call it the Arabian Gulf. The Department of the Navy, out of respect for our allies in the region, and I always say to Marines, if you are working with your Arab counterparts, please do not call that the Persian Gulf, just call it the Arabian Gulf.
Interesting. But there is the North Arabian Sea, yes?
Yeah, so different.
Different body of water.
Yep, different.
Got it. 90-20. Talk to us about politically. 90% of people live near the cities in Iran. How does that all break out in terms of... Because I think one of the things that if you ask most Americans, and I would tell you my understanding, is that the people of Iran... don't hate the people of the United States. I mean, there's a huge Iranian population in the United States. Well, let me ask you this. Is it Iranian or Iranian?
Iranian.
There's a huge population. See how cool this is? I'm learning now. I didn't know for sure, but...
That's not who you ask. Everybody calls it something different, right?
Right. I think most Americans would say, well, the Iranian people don't hate the American people. But we have this, the people that are in charge of the Iranian government, they hate the United States. And we have this thing going on. And if we could just get rid of that government, the two nations would get along famously. So could you tell what underlies the power, the political powers, and what are the competing factions inside of Iran?
Sure. So let me back up for a second.
Okay.
So I always like talking about this because I frequently get the question of, what do Iranians think about X?
Right.
What do Iranians think about X? And I always have to say, whoa, time out. Like, which Iranian are we talking about here? Because let me tell you something about Iranians culturally. If you have 10 Iranians in the room, and you ask them all one question, how many answers do you think you're going to get?
9.
You're going to get 15 answers. I'm telling you, you're going to get 15 answers. Because here's the deal. half of them are going to be confused about what the hell you're asking, and half of them are going to want to confuse the hell out of you. So you will get so many different answers if you ask 10 Iranians in the room one question. They're all going to tell you something different. They can't ever really agree on stuff. The one thing that historically has united Iranians is what they basically disagree about. It's kind of like the whole Shah of Iran argument. Right. Everybody knew they hated this guy, but nobody knew what the hell they wanted for Iran. That's why you had the one charismatic leader that essentially prevailed in all this, because he was organized, he had, you know, a following, et cetera, et cetera. So you have a lot of different opinions in Iran, and a lot of that is because Iran is a big country. You have people who live in different areas. You have to think the people who were more in rural areas or have family members that were raised in rural areas, they have a very different worldview compared to the person who lives in Tehran.
Right.
It is completely different. And if you look at their homes, the way they live, you know, it's just, it's a world of difference. The way they speak is different. Their accents are different. It's almost like, you know, I hate to say it, America's a huge freaking country. If you compare someone from New York to rural Texas, you're going to have some different opinions.
Well, and I would tell you that the major divide in the United States is the urban-rural divide. And so if you want to look at how Donald Trump, a guy like Donald Trump gets elected to be the president of the United States, you know, the big split is not racial. It's the view that the urban people have, which in my opinion is, you know, the government plays a huge role in our lives and enables us to do things where rural people believe I provide for me, and that's what has always made America great. And then you see that in the class. So I mean, I think that is all around the world, yes,
and around,
and around no different.
And when I say the rate of urbanization in Iran is at 90%, so let me backtrack a little bit. I would say that in rural areas of Iran, they have progressed and they have changed so much that sometimes defining what urban and rural is in Iran is very different. If you're looking up general statistics, they may cut back and tell you something like, you know, it's 80%, it's 78%, it's 82%.
Right.
I say 90% because even in the rural parts of the country, you would be very surprised to see how much their culture has really mimicked urban areas.
Right.
It is very different. I remember when I was in the most rural parts of the country where I'm talking, you would go to places, there's no electricity in the homes, you've got families that have, you know, 12 kids, but every person in that city, they are really mimicking, you know, even as far as not just the culture, but the schools, you know, the way in which people behave. They get everything from Tehran. So their behavior is even very urban. It was very interesting to watch to see in a short number of years how much those rural areas have, you know, really completely changed. So you do get a lot of different opinions. You have a lot of different views. But as far as the relationship and as far as what the view of America is, people will give you different opinions. I remember one time years ago when I was asking the question about nuclear weapons, I had an opportunity to talk to a lot of Iranians in previous work, and I'd asked people, I said, A, do Iranians want nuclear weapons? B, do they have nuclear weapons? Or C, is this just something that is completely against the religion, nobody wants it, you know, this is a blasphemous thing to even mention? You got so many different opinions in the room. There's some people who would even tell you Iran already has nuclear weapons, they just don't use it. Or they'll say in the 90s, after the fall of the Soviet Union, there were some nuclear weapons and nuclear materials that went missing. Oh, yeah, they're in Iran. There are people who believe a number of different things. Now, when it comes to the relationship with America, I'll tell you one thing that everyone is very, I would say, for the most part, on the same page about. And for the most part, I would say that's all based on sanctions.
Right.
Because today, the thing that's really different compared to about 10, 15 years ago, if you think about the arguments, the political arguments that existed in Iran 10, 15 years ago, they were very much domestic political. You know, we want some change in Iran. There was a green movement that happened, which we can certainly talk about. There were different opinions. There were reformist camps who wanted to see some change in the country, who wanted the doors to be opened up to the West. They wanted some liberalization as far as the country goes, with, you know, women being able to attend soccer matches or just having, you know, some ease and some relaxation of certain social policies, internet restrictions, all sorts of different things that really affected the youth. And then on the other side, you have people who say, look, if you start giving these things, the traditional conservatives, they say, if you start giving these things, they're only going to ask for more. And this is really going to be the downfall of the Islamic Republic. You got to think the number one enemy for the Islamic Republic, it's not Israel, it's not the United States, it's not Saudi Arabia, it's the Iranian people. And if the culture of the Iranian people changes, then that's going to open a lot of vulnerability to the Iranian government. That's going to threaten their survival. So they don't want to, there's a group of traditional conservatives. It's interesting, if you look at kind of the presidencies that we've been seeing even since the 90s, right? So President Rafsanjani in the 90s, interestingly, he was very conservative, but he was a pragmatic conservative. He actually wanted to do some business deals with the West because he was a money man. In fact, he at one point even advocated freeing, making the island of Kish in Iran a free trade zone so that they could turn it into a business. They wanted to compete with Dubai.
Right.
But he got shut down for that. And then you've got someone who comes in like President Khatami.
All right, Smitty, just back up and explain, why did they shut that down? Is it the whole domino theory that if we open that up, that's going to bleed into the country, and then it's going to make the problem of containing this thing harder? Why did the Iranian Dubai not work?
Absolutely. That's exactly why. This is against the foundational principles of the Islamic regime. The hardliner argument was, how can we justify something like this if we are the Islamic Republic of Iran? We can't do that.
Got it.
So it got a lot of backlash.
Got it. Now, for those of us, could you say his name again?
Rafsanjani.
Okay.
Now, he's dead now.
Who was the one who was in New York City? And again, my pronunciations are horrible. Who said we don't have gay people in Iran? I don't know who's talking.
Listen, I miss that guy because that was the most entertaining guy in Iranian politics. That dude was hilarious. So this was President Ahmadinejad. Say it with me. Ahmadinejad. That's it. Blah, blah, blah. That's all it is.
Right.
This guy was hilarious. I honestly think he was like the entertainment of the country. In fact, in Iran, they called him the janitor. Because the outfit that he wore, if you look at the outfits that the people in Iran who were like sweeping the streets, it looked like the exact same outfit, the little khaki jacket that he would always wear.
Right.
It was like the exact same outfit. So they called him like the janitor of Iran. But this guy was absolutely hilarious. I'll tell you the funniest thing. Every time, like one time he came to the UN,
right.
And before he makes any speech, the one thing that he would always say is, I pray for the speedy return of the hidden imam. And he would always talk about how this hidden imam, the one who is going to come and, it's all a part of the apocalyptic view of Shiism. This hidden imam is going to return to earth and bring about a just Islamic society and blah, blah, blah. And the funny thing is that in traditional Iranian Shiism, for you to even talk about the hidden imam is actually taboo. So the religious clergy, the clergy in Iran looks at something like that and is like, what is this guy talking about? Like, this is not true Shiism. You're not supposed to talk about that guy. Sometimes Ahmadinejad would even say that the hidden imam came and spoke to him in his dreams and his sleep, this and that, completely antithetical to the foundational principles of Shiism. You're not even supposed to talk about it. So he was a weird guy. He came out and he said in Iran there are no, gay people in Iran, which I find that personally kind of funny. In fact, if you talk to an Iranian, they'll tell you there's a city in Iran that is actually known for having a lot of gay people. I swear to you.
The audio from that night in New York City, the crowd starts laughing. I got her. And he says, I don't know who's told you such a thing, but in my country, we do not have such a thing. And everybody starts laughing more, and then they start catcalling and whistling and things like that. And
oh, it's hilarious.
It is. It's
and he calls it a phenomenon.
Right.
This phenomenon does not exist in Iran.
It was up there. I have that audio someplace. It is awesome. All right, keep going. You
it's
were
great.
Kind of talking about politically how it's migrated to today.
Yeah, so if you want to talk about Ahmadinejad's administration, for example, so we went from Rafsanjani, a president by the name of Khatami came after him. This guy was known to be like the happy cleric, like the happy mullah.
Okay, let me stop you again.
Yeah.
How are these people elected?
Good question. So I get this question a lot, like, hey, you know, in the Middle East, it's a monarchy everywhere, so Iran is the most democratic country that's in the Middle East. I would say yes and no. So in Iran, the way in which presidents are elected, so when it's election year, you got a lot of these people that put their name in the bucket, they say, there's like 1,000 people, they say, you know what, I want to run for president. But there is a body in the Iranian government called the Council of Guardians, also called the Guardian Council. It's a 12-member body. 6 of them are actually direct appointees by the supreme leader. And the other 6, they are nominated by the head of the judiciary, and then they are approved by the parliament. So that's how these 12 members get to this body called the Guardian Council. Now, funny thing, the head of the judiciary is also a direct appointee of the supreme leader. So guess where all 12 of those guys from the Guardian Council come from?
Let me guess, the supreme leader?
Surprise.
Nice. I like that.
He controls everything.
All right.
So the Guardian Council, what they basically do, all these people who want to put their name in the bucket to become president, they basically go through like a security clearance process. They say disqualified, disqualified, disqualified. They disqualify so many people who want to run for president because they say that their values are not in line with the values of the Islamic Republic. They are not trusted to carry the values of the regime. So if 1,000 people put their name in the bucket, at the end of the day, maybe 8 or 9 of them actually get approved to run for president. So they disqualify pretty much all of them. Except for the ones, oddly enough, who in Iran, if you're in politics, you never really get out of politics. You've been in politics for your entire life. So it's usually all the same people who have been involved in politics since the revolution started in 1979.
Ah.
So everyone who runs for president, these guys have been around for a long time. These are not like new faces that we're seeing.
Got it.
Some of them happen to be a little bit more moderate than others, but you 100% certainly are not getting the full spectrum of public opinion of 80 million people. And those 9 individuals where the rest of them have all been disqualified, you're really not getting the full spectrum of public opinion in there. So it's not really democracy if everyone's getting disqualified, right?
Not how we would certainly define it, but certainly they would say it's certainly representative government, yay?
Somewhat representative, but you're disqualifying so many people that you're probably representing just a small faction of individuals who truly believe and what those 8 or 9 individuals represent. That's why, historically, Iranians have boycotted so many elections, because they don't see the point in it.
Okay, once those 8 people are identified, is there integrity in the election system, or is there another hand that touches the scale?
That depends on who you ask, but I'm going to tell you no. There's not integrity in the system. There's integrity because people will go out and vote because of a number of different things that I would say are questionable.
Right.
For example, they have floating ballot boxes. Floating ballot boxes. You got guys that are in vans that are running around in rural areas picking up ballots, and they're not vetted. Or in more recent elections, you have members of the IRGC, that's the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. This is the elite military of the Islamic Republic. And they are essentially posting up in certain areas where the ballot boxes are. So there's a degree of intimidation as well. I would say for the most part, yeah, they, you know, elections are good, but they're definitely questionable practices when it comes to elections. But if you ask me, in my opinion, if the majority of people that are trying to run are disqualified in the first place, that's really the biggest problem.
My guest is Mrs. Smith. She's obviously making us smart, doing Iranian 101 with us today. Let me ask you an economics question, and then
sure.
Let me ask you a current events question, and I'll let you go as we've taken up about an hour of your time.
Sure, no problem.
The economic question. Talk to us about Iran economically. What is it? I think we all understand, you know, petroleum in the region, but explain Iran to us economically.
How about I, because that's a big loaded question. How about I explain some of the problems with Iran economically?
That's fine. You're the expert. You slice it any way you want to.
Man, expert is such a hard title to accept.
Imagine if
somebody says you're an expert on the United States of America. Like, what the hell does that even mean?
Right? I would just say yes. Hello, it's nice to be here. Right? Why not?
Well, I'm going to do my best. I'm going to do my best with that title. That's a very strong title, but I'm going to do my best here.
All right.
So, problems with Iran, economically speaking. So, of course, Iran, based on, you know, their resources, oil, natural gas, things like that, we've got sanctions in place. But what we don't really talk about is that Iran also has a lot of poor economic practices domestically. A lot of the economy is actually controlled by the IRGC, and I'm actually kind of surprised that the IRGC didn't come up a little bit sooner in this discussion, because in order to understand Iran, you really have to understand the role of the IRGC. That's the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Right.
During the Iran-Iraq War, the IRGC was really established as a frontline response to Saddam Hussein and his military. So they started out primarily with a military function, and then after the Iran-Iraq War, there was a big question. There was a lot of anxiety with this organization that was established, along with its subcomponents, the Basij, which is a paramilitary organization, works under the IRGC. The Quds Force is probably an organization that's especially in the DOD, a lot of people know about, because that's the special forces wing of the IRGC.
Right.
After the Iran-Iraq War, there was a big question of, well, what are these guys going to do? There was a ton of anxiety. And because the Islamic Republic knew that members of the IRGC and their subcomponents were the most loyal individuals to government, they didn't want to just disband them or let them go, so they started getting them involved in the economy. As a matter of fact, former President Rafsanjani, he was the one who basically set up the IRGC to say, look, we're going to give you guys a job. Don't worry. Don't have anxiety. Don't think that just because the war is over that you guys are going to go away and you're not going to have jobs. We're going to give you jobs. And so they started involving them in all these different national programs. Of course, after a country goes through war, they got to rebuild the country, right?
Right.
So all of the contracts to rebuild the country were given to the IRGC.
Wow.
They were given to a company, for example, this is like the Booz Allen on steroids of Iran, called Khatam al-Anbiya. And this organization, this contracting company today, is huge. They own a number of contracts, not just in Iran, but, for example, the parts of the electric grid in Iraq were built under this company. They have contracts in Afghanistan. They have contracts outside of the country. It's controlled by the IRGC, and the head of it is an IRGC member. So this is an organization that has essentially really helped to make the IRGC not only very rich, but also very powerful. So all these different contracts throughout the country, whether it's electricity, whether it's oil, natural gas, all these different things, this is how the IRGC started getting rich and really put their foot in, economically speaking. Now, the third level of that with the IRGC, when Ahmadinejad came into power, that essentially paved the way for the IRGC to become more involved in politics. Members of his cabinet were IRGC members, former IRGC members. Really, if you're ever a member of the IRGC, you're never really out of the IRGC. It's almost like once a Marine, always a Marine, right? So if you're a member of the IRGC, you're never not a member. So Ahmadinejad really started helping to populate and pave the way for the IRGC to also become members of the political communities. And now that you have them controlling security sectors, economic sectors, and now political sectors, they've really eclipsed pretty much every sector of Iran, every sector of Iranian society. They're in control. They've got a lot going on. So now where all that goes wrong? Well, I'll give you just one example of some of the way in which policies work economically. When Ahmadinejad was president, they decided to have this idea to remove subsidies. This is just one example. Subsidies in Iran affect usually the middle class or higher, because if you're middle class, you've got multiple cars, you've got a big house, you've got, you know, a lot of expenses, you have a small family.
Right.
So if subsidies are in place, you know, you're really alleviating a lot of the pain from your electricity bill, you know, fuel for your car.
Right.
All the things that you buy to make the wheels turn, right?
Right.
But subsidies don't really affect poor families. In rural Iran, and I guess you could say really the primary voter base of the ultra hardline sectors in Iranian society, subsidies didn't really benefit them. They got a small house. They may have one little light in the middle of the room. They've got 10 kids. They don't have a car. So subsidies didn't help them. So when they removed them, in place of removing those subsidies, what they decided to do, and this is just hilarious in my opinion, they decided to give the equivalent of about $40 per person. Just drop it in their bank account every month. $40. That's how we're going to move away from subsidies. We're just going to give people this stipend, $40 a month, to help them transition. So when you go from, you know, subsidies are helping like maybe $700-$800 for this rich, wealthy family, and they got four people in their entire family, they're getting $40 a person, that's $160 that family is getting, and they've lost about $800 in subsidies a month. Now compare that to the poor family. They got 10 kids. Subsidies didn't mean shit for them. So if you got $40 per person in a family of 10, now that poor family with a dad that was a factory worker who was making maybe like $150 a month, now he's making $400 a month doing nothing. And that's how they do income reshuffling. So now, back when Ahmadinejad was president and this was happening, well, what happened? People started quitting work in the factory. Because they were like, well, what am I going to work for? I'm making all this money. Government's paying me all these handouts. What am I going to need to work for? So factories started shutting down.
Me.
All sorts of issues happened. And then fast forward another issue. I mean, you know, JCPOA, some people liked it, some people hated it. The fact is that it was signed. Money was given back to the government. The money that was given back to the government didn't go to really anything other than supporting its Iranian DOD ventures throughout the region, let's just say. Didn't really help to fix all these different policies domestically. You got all these factories shut down, middle classes going down. The Pious Poor, who's the voter base of the hardline individuals in Iran, they're doing a little bit better. But that doesn't sustain itself. That doesn't last forever. The bank started running out of money when people were going to the banks to get their $40 a month out.
Uh-oh.
So now the economy is starting to collapse. You have a number of different issues that stem from a lot of domestic bad policies like this. And when the budget gets cut, the organizations and the different entities that continue getting funded are all the religious organizations and military organizations that only support the people who are in power. And this is part of the reason why you have a lot of issues domestically in the country. Now, back to JCPOA, signing that, releasing funds, this and that, you know, an unintended consequence of JCPOA, which, you know, you can love it, you can hate it. I'm going to save my personal opinion on this, hopefully for the next time. But this was signed, and an unintended consequence was that after the United States, the greatest country in the world, puts a foot forward and signs this deal with Iran, it didn't help the Iranian government, it didn't help the Iranian economy at all. Things still went south. Why? Because they have bad domestic policies. They're corrupt. You got multimillionaire clerics that have so much money while the rest of the country is being neglected of all the basic things that they need to survive. So the unintended consequence of the Iranian government economically still going down, and we already signed the deal, but when we actually came back in and reinserted ourselves in the argument and basically decided to squash JCPOA, we kind of made ourselves relevant again in that discussion. I actually thought that right after JCPOA, it was a wonderful thing because the Iranian people were saying, you know what? At least at the end of the day, the United States put a foot forward, and now we know that the economic problems are not because of the Western world. It's domestic. Iranian people were pointing the finger at their own country. They were pointing the finger at their own government's incompetence in running the country. They say this is not the fault of America. America put the foot forward, and this is it. We still have problems in this country.
Is that the genesis of the Green Movement?
I would say the Green Movement has evolved to something totally different today. The Green Movement was something that existed years ago, or actually I should say started years ago, and was essentially a political reform movement.
Uh-huh.
But today, when you talk about opposition in Iran, it is so wide scale. It's almost like years ago they were, you know, having this argument about politics and who's in government and we want, you know, social liberalization and all these different things to change domestically. But listen, when you're messing with money, that's across the board.
Right.
If you're religious, conservative, liberal, man, woman, old, young, when it's about money, it affects everybody. So the opposition today, the argument today is not a political reform movement. It's an argument against incompetence in the Iranian government. It's a totally different discussion. As a matter of fact, if you think about the Green Movement, some of the protests that they were, the things that they were chanting, you know, death to the dictator. You know, the government is this, the government is that, we got to get rid of the government, where's my vote, blah, blah, blah. It's all political, right?
Right.
If you listen to the chants today, boy, it gets really interesting. Could you believe that some of the chants today in Iran are, it's not death to America, it's not death to Israel, no, you still hear that. But it's not all just only that. They're also chanting things like death to Palestine. Oh, that's interesting. Why would they be chanting something like that? Well, it's about money. They know that the Iranian government is spending a lot of money overseas. And if you really want to get into this Persian-Arab divide, if you really want to, you know, poke an Iranian, a Persian with a short stick, you tell them that the Iranian government is depriving Iranians of basic needs and being able to put food on the table to go and support Arabs. And Iranian people don't like this. So a lot of domestic issues, I would say economically speaking, it's not just about oil. It's not just about sanctions. It's also about how the Iranian government has been running that country for its domestic economic policies. That has created a number of issues which has compounded all the problems that already exist.
So, we see these kind of problems in totalitarian states around the world. That, you know, the basis, we can't have open, you know, trade and capitalism because the free exchange of ideas seeps into our culture and undermines this way of life that we've chosen to run our country by. Iran is no exception relative to that. Do we focus too much on the role of petroleum and the role of oil in Iran, or is it that important to the economy?
Oh, it's very important to the economy. It's a staple in the economy. But it's not, my argument is that it's not the only thing.
Right.
If you have, you know, all the oil in the world, if you've got bad domestic policies, if you don't know how to run a country, then all that oil is not really going to help you. And I think Iranian people are really starting to recognize that. Most Iranians will tell you Iran, no matter what, is a rich country. There's no reason why Iran should have to have so many economic issues. I mean, if you think about it, Iranians today are about 20% poorer than they were 15 years ago. That's pretty significant.
Right.
People have some serious issues, and it's caused a number of other social issues. The rate of divorce has skyrocketed in the last 10, 15 years. Young people are not getting married. The unemployment rate for the youth, which I would say is about the age of 35 and younger, is about 40%. That's pretty significant. So people don't entirely blame, you know, sanctions and oil for things like this when they know that there's a lot of corruption. It's in their face. They know that there are a lot of domestic issues. So the conversation is not always entirely about oil.
All right, a final question for you, and this is the current events question. And this is, and you're gonna tell me I can't answer it, but I'm gonna ask anyway. The missiles fired, allegedly fired from Iran into Saudi Arabia. Who was the intended target of that move? Was that for internal consumption? Was that targeted at somehow or other swaying European support for sanctions relief? Can you give me an opinion on that's a bit of a head scratcher for me. Can you enlighten me in terms of the why behind that?
So that's a very tricky question because I think there are a number of different directions to go with that.
All right.
But with that being said, let me try to answer it in a different way.
Okay.
There's both desperation and demonstration of strength here.
Right.
Desperation because the Iranian government is really looking for a way to change the situation. Demonstration of strength.
Okay, when you say change the situation, what situation are you talking about?
Economically speaking.
Okay.
They've got problems. Economically speaking, they have a lot of problems. And here's the thing. If the primary recruiting pool of the IRGC and the Basij and all these different individuals who have traditionally supported the Islamic Republic are now joining in grievance with all the other individuals in the country that have had problems with the Islamic Republic for a number of years, that's how you know the government has a lot of problems. They are really starting to get worried if they do not fix this economic situation domestically. So that's their desperation. But demonstration of strength because they know, remember I said the lesson from the Iran-Iraq war was that they need a lot of friends in the region. They know that they need a lot more regional influence, and they got it. And this is just one example, and I'm not going to fully answer your question here, but this is just one example, in my humble opinion, of demonstration of strength to say, look, if things don't start happening, we have the ability to turn it on in the region, and we have the ability to turn it off in the region. So that is just one of many examples that we've been seeing, in addition to, you know, all the militia groups that are operating in Iraq, in addition to what's going on in Yemen, in addition to Lebanon, and a number of other places, not just in the Middle East, but also beyond.
So the messaging is designed for external consumption because I've had discussions with people on this program about is it a message crafted for internal consumption that say, don't attempt to talk to the Americans because, you know, we can very easily create distance and create a larger gap. I've heard that as well.
Well, the Iranian government is never going to admit to participating in things like that.
Right.
They're not going to admit that. So the narrative based on the target audience is going to be very different. It's almost like when you look at an Iranian news story and you see, for example, two paragraphs and you see a picture. And if you click on that exact same article in all the different languages that they provide that article in, the picture is the same, the length of the paragraphs are the same, but the context and the actual narrative in those two paragraphs is very different because it's meant for a different target audience. So there could be one incident that serves a different purpose for every target audience.
Wow.
And I think this is certainly one of them.
All right. First of all, Mrs. Smith. I've never had anybody come on and be able to talk about Iran like this. So I want to thank you for doing it, taking the time out of your day. And I know you're busy.
My pleasure.
And hopefully in the not too distant future, we can come back and we can expand on everybody's knowledge of, you know, not only the nation of Iran, but also you can get your secret decoder ring out and explain to us, you know, Iran's influence in Iraq, Iran's influence in Syria, in Lebanon, and Yemen, and how they've expanded their influence so greatly over the course of the last 20 to 30 years, certainly the last 18 years. So thank you very much for doing this.
I would love to. It'd be my pleasure. Thanks.
All right. Don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. Mrs. Smith. Yeah, how about that? That's pretty cool. So, Grant Newsham's other half. No, I mean, I could have done that for another 2 hours, but she's very gracious with her time, so I appreciate that. Anyway, we'll have her back and talk about, if there's anything you'd specifically like me to raise with her, let me know, but, you know, we'll raise with her all the different things that we see around the world that Iran's involved in. Make this make sense for us. Make this make sense to us. Make this make sense to us. Right? But I think if one of the things she pounded on was the lessons that Iran learned about the region after the Iran-Iraq war, which was we don't have any friends. And we need to lest the region focus on us, we need to create other disturbances in the region so that they have other things to focus on other than just us. So, interesting. No, my thanks to Mrs. Smith for coming on. Pretty awesome. And again, that's just the beginning. And trying to cover Iran, you know, not so easy in 70 minutes maybe. So, my thanks to her for doing that. So, pretty exciting. I'm geeked about it anyway. All right, Alex Hollings will join us tomorrow. And then Grant Newsham's going to join us on... Grant Newsham's going to join us on Wednesday. So, should be a cool week. And, make sure you download 3 Goals and 9 Commandments. Make sure that you keep your ears open for opportunities to touch somebody else's life. I had another one of those days again. I started the show with it, I'll end the show with it on Friday, where it's happened to me over and over throughout the course of my day. And they're the best days that you have. So, with that said, on a Monday, All Marine Radio is over and out.